Some say that we don't have any culture in America, that our culture is all the comic book culture, and that we really have no culture. But I never believed them in my whole life, and I believe them less now than I ever did, because I have seen in my life our culture persist and endure and grow and have its young sprouts and new fertility in the face of depression and wars and cataclysms and atom bombs, and our culture goes on. And sometimes it's very difficult for the workers in our culture to persist. And that is one of the reasons of our meeting here tonight. And I hope that we can continue and hear original compositions and our artists through the winter months. We have come through a long period, a trying period in America in the last 10 years, let us say. The night has been somber, but man provides always his brotherly signals. And the major signal that man always provides is the cultural signal, the signal of song, of poetry, of myth, of legends. And I think the period since 1945 in America has been very pregnant with these symbols and these gestures and these signals to each other. Since the beginning of our country, our culture has been somewhat of an underground culture. Our people have expressed themselves and had to express themselves in underground ways and in torturous struggles. And they have expressed the song and the legend and the myth of our country in these ways. Today, in this darkness, we see the world peoples rising, the colonial peoples rising, and expressing their anonymous and submerged life that we have been ignorant of, and our life has been anonymous and submerged to them, perhaps. One of the thrilling things of my life in this time is the fact that I received letters from China, from Poland, from Czechoslovakia, asking me to send copies of my books to them. And you actually feel that a whole new audience is growing up, is emerging. I was just reading a little pamphlet about opera in China the other day. And I wish that Wilbur Brahms, one of our major singers tonight, could sing an opera in China. Although I'm glad he's here tonight. But here he is, a fine opera singer who has struggled and has attained the skill of his craft, and he has a difficult time finding a place to sing. Well, we writers have encountered this difficulty for a long, long time. So tonight, I feel a special privilege in all of us being here and honoring Wilbur Brahms and our other creative artists who have kept on this dark period and have learned their skill and have searched out the audience and gone on. And I believe that we are on the verge of a great light, of a great culture. For example, more poetry today is sold in China than in America. More of Mark Twain is interpreted in India. The other day I was trying to find some cheap editions of Mark Twain, And actually, you can send to India and get an English translation of Mark Twain cheaper than you can get from America. Well, it's a strange and wonderful and beautiful thing that perhaps there is a great cultural movement in the world today that is hungry for singers, for poets, for culture, and perhaps in America we can furnish some of this culture. So I feel that tonight we have come out of the winter of our days, and that here we are honoring some artists who have come out of our own culture, out of our own roots, out of our own furrow. All of these artists have come out of our life, of our struggle, some of them since the 30s, some of them in the whole history of our time. And believe me, these artists and these people who understand and feel the suffering and the vitality of our life are going to be the great artists of the future. I know that. I'm convinced of that. Well, it's no good to talk about art. You have to see it and feel it, and it has to present itself to you. So we're beginning tonight's program with a piano duet, the Hungarian Divertissement and the Slay by Justine O'Connor and Catherine Buchner. And I just asked Justine how they were a duet. I know that Catherine Buchner lives way out in the country, and Justine lives on the other side of Minneapolis, which is nowhere in St. Paul. I mean, the most remarkable thing that they should be a duet. Well, you see, that's the international situation. And Justine said that whenever they get together, they play a duet. So this is the outcome of that tremendous alliance between Minneapolis and St. Paul. So our first number will be a piano duet, Hungarian Divertissement by Schubert and the Slay a la Russe by Kunz by Justine O'Connor and Catherine Buchner. Thank you. Republican and Democratic committee, I've almost left you without the privilege of saying it's with great pride and pleasure. I'm against the expropriation of words, so I just keep on saying it is a great pride that I introduce the next singer, Wilbur Brahms, whom many of us have known for all of our lives. And if there's any person who has determined to sing in the midst of disaster, it's Wilbur Brahms. He was born just prior to the Great Depression, and he fought in the Second World War, and Wilbur Brahms insisted upon singing in the face of these great world cataclysms and disasters. And I honor him greatly for this, that he insisted upon the virtues of song against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, against all of the tremendous barriers that is put up against the artist to become a singer or an artist of any kind. I sometimes think that singers, I feel very much that writers are in a bad position. But you know, we can write. In the Depression, I wrote a whole short story on a roll of toilet paper. they couldn't stop you. A singer, that's something different. I mean, a singer has got to have somebody to sing to. He can't just sing to a roll of toilet paper. I mean, he's got to have an audience. And my brother, who is an artist, I feel the same thing about him. I mean, he paints pictures, and he has to have a great outlay of money. A writer is hard up, but a painter or a singer or a musician is harder upper. So Wilbur Brahms, I feel, is has set an example of feeling that singing is important, that singing is a contribution to humanity. It's a contribution to the struggle of humanity. And his mother and his wife and the people around him have contributed to that struggle, I think, also. And the feeling that it is important to sing. And this is it's not a problem just now. I mean, in America, if you couldn't chop wood or draw water, you weren't much good. The singer and the poet was not something you could sell. I remember in my youth, I wanted to be a writer, and everybody said, "Well, how will you live?" Well, I look pretty good. I look better than if I just used the wood and drawn the water. The water isn't worth drinking now anyway. So I feel very, very pleased tonight. And in fact, this is the center of our meeting here tonight, to hear Wilbur sing. And I think he is one of the persons who is bound to sing. And we are bound to hear him, and it's a great honor to do that. He was swept into the struggle in the 30s as a young adolescent, and he was part of our struggles in this state. And then he was swept into the Second World War, where he was in the army. And after that, he went on with his singing. And he studied here and in New York, and he sang here for KFCP and WCCO, and some of us heard him sing for the concerts in St. Paul. He sang on television on NBC for Billy Budd and De Rosa Cavalier, and the Irish songs on the Ted Steele show. He traveled with the Met Opera tour of the Fledermaus, and he He sang with the Amato City Center and Cincinnati Operas. And he has had a struggle that we all have to be heard today. And I feel it's a great privilege for us to gather here in this summer evening and hear Wilbur sing. And every summer that he returns, his voice has become greater, richer, warmer, fuller of the feeling of human struggle and human love. And it's a great pleasure tonight to welcome our son, Wilbur Brown.
Oh,
hope we'll sing again. Now, our next number is a really great phenomena, I think, in our... Although, I don't know, you know, nowadays, I remember when a speaker was speaking here who came from, who had been in India, he said, there are no meetings nowadays except for 1 million people. And any meeting in less than 1 million is a small meeting. Well, this is the same thing is true of choruses. This first one, Monica, is written by a writer, which some of you know many of her songs. She's a white-maned woman who lives on the coast and writes songs there for everything that happens. I mean, if anybody has a baby, she writes a song. If anybody doesn't have a baby, she writes a song. If she gets married, and it's really wonderful. And she writes these songs just like the folk songs are always written. And she sent this to Mike Baker, this Monaco, and, you know, this affair took place on that miserable island, Monaco, where they don't even have plumbing. So they're going to sing this Malvina Reynolds song. And our chorus has sung many of her songs, and they're really beautiful. And she would like to hear some of our songs, which we produce here, which we really should send her. Because we produce some very good things here, too. And so we're going to have these four songs in the chorus. Monica, Wandering, They Call the Wind Mariah, and Great Day.
Mine.
one is the folk song Wanderin'.
I'm
going to
sing the Wind Mariah next.
Oh, the Wind Mariah next.
Thank you. so often is the case, one of these old, great old songs happens to be just as true today and just fit in a place in our modern life, too. This song was used, perhaps probably still is, I don't know, but we heard that it had been used in the Montgomery, Alabama bus strike, in which the Negro people have been boycotting the buses. The name of the song is Great Day, and the words are very appropriate. Great day, the righteous marching. God's going to build up Zion's wall. It's a song of confidence, and it's a song of walking.
Has spent his whole life in the Middle West, coming from a Jewish tradition and heritage. And this, I think, contributes and will contribute a great deal to the compositions of the Middle West and to his compositions on the Rosenberg Suite. I think that Lionel Davis also is a remarkable composer of the working class, a person who works all day in the railroad and studies music, piano, and composes in the evening. And his wife aids him and is also a writer. And this is the way that our culture develops. The author of, you remember the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin? She wrote, she had just buried a baby. She was burying another child. She was stirring the pot, stew, and the cradle with one foot. And this is the way that our culture develops. And I think that Wilbur's compositions are of a remarkable poignancy and passion and quality. And he is just beginning to compose some of these remarkable reflections of the great struggle of our life in America. And this Rosenberg Suite is composed of a lullaby with the words by his wife, Edith Davis. And the people's voices rise, and the hymn for peace and bread and roses. And then the final one from the beautiful poem by Ethel Rosenberg to her sons called If We Die. And these are sung by Wilbur Brahms. And this, I feel, is a great first premiere of this suite to the Rosenbergs. Lionel Davis and Wilbur Brahms.
Sleep, my son, while I dream of the glorious man you will be, of the songs you'll sing, the joys that you'll bring tomorrow, my son. My son, you are tiny, wrinkled, and red, but your feet will rot themselves deep in the earth, and your hands will reach for the and build my son's work and build.